Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. All right, we've talked a lot of Game 7. First hour, wholly devoted, really, to Game 7 tonight, which is fitting because, as we were talking about, I can't remember a bigger game in NHL, certainly since I've been following it. So this is a massive one tonight. But we are Canucks talk, so we got to look ahead to the Canucks offseason as well. Of course, the draft later this week. Free agency 1 week from today.
You know, even among Canucks fans, I feel like the appetite is mostly for the game. Not saying we'll like deviate. I'm just saying it's an unusual one in that I feel like the stakes are so high. It's so riveting. People are so annoyed that it's the Oilers in this spot that I actually feel like Canucks fans, you know, just generally like on Twitter, on and on. Like I see some people being like, John Marino. I see some John Marino Seagulls. I see some Tyler Toffoli Seagulls. But for the most part, I feel like most of us are just Game 7 Seagulls. Just like hockey.
It's hard not
to. Bring me hockey.
It's hard not to be, right? I mean, it's game set. Like, I was talking Game 7 overtime hasn't happened. What? There's only been 18 Stanley Cup Final Game 7s ever, right? Yep. Like, it's pretty rare. There was 2011, of course, 2019, and now this one. So that's three times in the last, I don't even remember what the last one before that would have been.
All of those have been anticlimactic. Uh-huh. What we haven't really seen in a while. I remember the Pittsburgh-Detroit one pretty well.
Yes.
But that was a really good game. But we haven't had like a really tightly contested in doubt throughout Game 7 in a long time. So hopefully we get one tonight.
Yeah, hopefully we get one tonight. And I mean, it's pretty easy to get, even putting aside the comeback and the fact that it's the Oilers and the fact that it's Connor McDavid. It's hard not to get wrapped up in the excitement of that type of game potentially happening. And again, fingers crossed for that overtime finish tonight. But as you said, there's also some interesting Canucks stuff to talk about out there. Do you want to start with perfect off-season content? Do you want to start with John Marino, backup, Jake Guentzel options? Where do you want to start here?
Well, I think it all leads us to the same place, to be totally honest with you. Right? Like, so let's start with perfect, I guess. Because the exercise of thinking through, you know, so me and Harmon do this exercise every year. We get on the phone, we spend a couple hours sort of working through what we think matters, and we're really trying to illustrate concepts more than we are to
target individual players or anything like
100%.
That.
100%. Yep. But, you know, I think it's a useful exercise in terms of figuring out the exact shape of like what matters for a team, right? Like last year, we did two. Because until this year, there's always been like two routes that the Canucks could take, one longer view and one shorter view. Mm-hmm. And now I think they're too pot committed for a long view offseason to make sense, right? So like in the comment section of that Athletic article, people are like, why aren't you spending more time talking about the risk of signing Jake Guentzel for 8 years, given that he's 30? And it's like, because the Canucks need a star level player now, you know, like, I mean, is there a conversation to be had about a year ago, everyone thought this team, including management, thought this team was so flush with wingers that drafting for need was a real consideration? And now it's like, really, what they need is a star winger, right? I mean, is there a conversation to be had about that? Sure, but I don't think it's a particularly pertinent one. The fact is that this team right now, with the ages of JT Miller, with the performances of their star players, with the fact that at some point this week, Quinn Hughes is probably going to win the Norris, right? With where they've gotten themselves to, with the rapid progress made under Rick Tocchet, you know, I don't think expectations for this season should be set south of, expectations for this offseason should be set south of, can this management group take that next step and set this team up to credibly compete for the Stanley Cup? Contend, right? Like, that's where we're at. That's the stakes are enormous. I don't think it makes sense to even think about what it looks like to like stretch out this build or even think about like sustainability in the sorts of ways that we have been talking about, you know, the time for that passed.
Yeah, it would be bizarre. It would be a bizarre pivot from this team and this management
for
group
sure,
at this point.
Especially with the path they've taken. I mean, like, even things like Michkov, right? Like Michkov coming over to sign with the Philadelphia Flyers, and it's like, you know, the Canucks finished so hot toward the tail end of that last Bruce Boudreau, first Rick Tocchet season, right? End up clearing the Philadelphia Flyers in the last 3 weeks of the year, and Michkov's going to come over and be a star level player. You know, like, even, and now the story that this management group tells, and I think it's a compelling one after what we saw last season, is we needed that runway with Tocchet to get moving in the right direction. Okay, fine, but like, the cost of that is already due, right? Like, the cost of that is already, we can already see the cost of that now, and it was only like 18 months ago or two years ago. So, you know, I do think it was 18 months ago. So I do think I just think that's worth like bearing in mind, considering, right? The way that this club has behaved has put them into a spot where there's one way forward. And the good news about that is, at the very least, they won 50 games and won their division and pushed the Oilers to 7 games in the playoffs and did it without Demko and lost Brock Besser in game 7. And like, at least it's fun. At least they're close enough to knocking on the door that thinking about adding to this team, whether you think it's structurally the most probable path to deliver a Stanley Cup to Vancouver or not, we can reasonably expect this team to be good next year. We can reasonably expect that if they can add the right pieces, they could be really good. So, you know, this year anyway, we didn't even do the like sort of fork in the road model of the perfect offseason. We just talked about what this team needs to do to put itself in a position to contend, to put itself in a position to level up and contend credibly for the Stanley Cup. Now, I always think it's useful, though, like, again, we're outlining concepts. So, like, last year, for example, when we did the plan to make the playoffs in 2024, don't qualify Bear, but re-sign him to an affordable one-year contract. Well, they didn't re-sign him, but they didn't qualify him. So, half points awarded.
Sure.
Push to extend Pettersson with less emphasis on a max term outcome. They got the max term outcome. Hoglander to a one-year show-me contract. They signed him for two years. Pay the price if necessary, but shed at least $8 million in committed salary, and that included be willing to use a buyout if push comes to shove. We all know that both those things happened. Make a hockey trade to reallocate money from the wings into center or defense. They made two. They just made them in season, right? Acquire a top four caliber defenseman. I actually don't know that they did that.
No.
They just got top four caliber output from a couple four or five guys. Acquire two reliable third pair options with some upside. They did that. Acquire a high-end middle six center. They ultimately did that, but at the deadline. And sign an experienced depth goaltender, which they did in a trade.
They traded for it, yeah.
But the point is, again, we're not trying to like actually say the moves. We're just trying to go through and figure out the shape of, like, what are the pressure points for the Canucks this offseason? What are the range of reasonable outcomes that we can expect here? So everything we focused on today, or in our article today, which you can go read at The Athletic, is really focused on landing a star top-level winger, like a top-line contributor, top-of-the-lineup difference maker for the Vancouver Canucks. And I think that's appropriate. Like, I think that's how it should be in terms of what matters for the Canucks this summer. And the reason that I think this matters is I just can't escape the feeling that even without Demko and Besser and all the other stuff, even though they shot 13% plus in that series against the Oilers, when push came to shove with two opportunities to advance to the conference final, like, the Canucks scored one goal until the last 8 minutes when they capitalized off two really heinous Edmonton mistakes because the Oilers relaxed in a 3-0 game. You know, they had 16 shots a game. They scored three goals across two games. It felt like they were carrying a knife at a gunfight against, you know, the weaponry that is McDavid and Dreisaitl. And I don't know how you level that up unless you land, you know, the superstar level guy to complement Pettersson or to complement Miller and Besser on the top line. Like, that's the top six, the ability to generate shots. And again, we focused on this. I was talking about it all year. Vancouver's sort of overall struggle to generate shots. And, you know, I personally just struggle to move past the fact that this Stanley Cup final is being contested by the two teams that generated quality looks better than anyone else in the sport versus the, you know, Canucks, who ranked 25th in shot rate, 5-on-5, right? Only the Coyotes, the Red Wings, the Canadiens, the Ducks, the Blackhawks, the Sharks, the Capitals generated fewer. Well, I'm not able to move past that. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a flaw that if it remains, if it persists, if this team struggles to generate looks to that level again next season, they're a fringe playoff team. Forget being a contender. They're a fringe playoff team. Like, they need to significantly upgrade their ability to break down and attack opponents offensively. You're probably not going to lead the league in shooting percentage again. And so this is like the critical issue. So we start with the idea of adding a top line difference making forward. And then we kind of get to avoiding committing cap space to your plan Bs.
Well, and I think the plan B conversation is a really important one, right?
For
because
sure.
As much as we've heard, you know, the Canucks are going to be really in on Jake Gensel, and there was the Frank Saravalli report, like, hey, there might be a fit there in terms of money, in terms of, you know, ability to win, all of that. In general, if you're targeting one big free agent, the likelihood is that you don't get that free agent. That's how free agency works, right? If they're really, really good, they're going to be very in demand. They're going to have a lot of teams willing to throw money at them. You're going to have to throw even more money to get them to your city generally. So generally, it's not going to happen.
And that might not be enough, right? Like,
yeah.
Once you get to, when you're talking about the apex UFAs, right? Like, John Tavares wanted to play for his hometown team,
mm-hmm.
right? Artemi Panarin wanted to play on Broadway and left money on the table to do it. Parise and Suter wanted to play together in the Midwest.
Johnny Gaudreau wanted to go to Columbus.
Well, no, but Johnny Gaudreau wanted to be a short flight away from their family.
Close to home, but not that close.
Well, it's because the Flyers didn't have cap space.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he would have been a Flyer if they'd had the money for it. So, you know, the differing, like, quality of life, taxes, family considerations, proximity to home, teams you grew up supporting, in relationships with people in the hockey operations staff or potential future teammates. Just a desire to, like, play in a big hockey market, be part of the show, versus, hey, I'd actually prefer the anonymity of not doing that, are all proved decisive. So you can't count on just landing yep. And there's three guys, right? Reinhardt, Marchessault, Gensel would be the three wingers of the caliber that we're talking about, like real superstar level game changers. People will bring up Stamkos too, but while I think he's awesome, don't get me wrong, his 5-on-5 generation at mm-hmm. this stage of his career isn't quite at the level that I think the team needs. And his fit on the power play, to me, like, I struggle to see it, given that he's another guy who you'd want to operate off of that left
where
circle
where
JT Miller eats.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, I think you'd move JT Miller.
Well, you'd have Stamkos. You got Steven Stamkos, yeah.
Right. So you'd move, and Miller could do that fine. So, I see the Stamkos fit, I guess, but not really. I just think 5-on-5 is what really matters most for this team. So, anyway, when you get past those three names.
And really, I mean, Reinhardt, now I guess we'll see what happens if the Panthers lose, right? If that throws things into, like, I guess all bets are off them, but it feels like Reinhardt's not going to be there.
Correct.
And I would be a little surprised if Marchessault is there, right? Not a huge shock necessarily, but
I wouldn't be shocked if Marchessault is there. I would be shocked if, like, he's 34.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know. If I was Canucks management, I'd chase Marchessault. He doesn't feel like he's fast enough or big enough to be like a big Rutherford target.
So it's three names, but really it feels like cumulatively like one and a half names, right? With Gensel, and then it's like, oh, Reinhardt or Marchessault, kind of, but yeah, I don't know.
So point is there's a relatively high probability that doesn't succeed.
Yep. And that's not, and again, I want to be clear, like, again, that's the case for every team.
Correct.
You are most likely not to get the big high profile free agent. So you better have a really good plan B. And for me, and I know you guys touch on this, but that's always where I think the biggest mistakes can happen in free agency, right? Is like, well, we wanted to get true superstar. We didn't, because that's how free agency works. But we got to do something with this money now. So, hey, guys who are next up in line, come on down and we'll give you the money.
Yeah. And I mean, there's good players. Like, I like Chandler Stephenson. I like Tyler Toffoli, right? Like, I like Jake DeBrusk. I think all of those guys could be helpful. Teuvo Teravainen. Not only do I think they could be helpful, there's a world, depending on the valuation, where adding a player like that is in fact sharp for the Canucks, where it fits and works mm-hmm. and makes a ton of sense, improves this team. And I'd add this. I think this team probably needs multiple top six forwards. So, you know, is there a world where maybe if you can land a couple floor bet type guys, like maybe if you can bring in Toffoli and Stevenson, the return of Pettersson to health and JT Miller and maintaining his form is like enough to help those guys elevate. I'm open to the idea, but I do think that in a world where you're not able to land one of the apex level UFAs, and when I say that, I'm just trying to be polite and not specifically say Jake Guentzel, you pivot. When you pivot, excuse me, you have to pivot in such a way where you're back to behaving with a little bit more responsibility in mind, where you're not breaking the bank necessarily, mm-hmm. where you're not going, you know, 6 million times 6 for Teuvo Teravainen, or, you know, 5 million times 4 for Tyler Toffoli, right? Like where I think you start to need to count your ducats, as it were, with a level of like conservative creativity more in line with how this team was built this year during the unrestricted free agent period, as opposed to team loses out on Lucic and, you know, empties the cartridge to chase Louis Erickson. So as part of that and sort of expanding on it, and we've gotten into some of these takes already on the show, but be willing to dangle premium assets to acquire a star level winger, yep. I think is part of a good plan B, a good, healthy plan B.
I think that's the first plan B.
Yeah,
if you don't let, like that more than any of the other free agent targets, plan B is if you don't get Jake Guentzel or you don't think you have a really, really high probability of getting him, right? Because we're going into the draft before free agency when a lot of these trades happen. If you've done your due diligence and you're evaluating, you know what, we're probably not going to get Guentzel, then you have to be willing to go out and make a splash for a big time winger, a big time star player at the draft before free agency.
Well, and you have weaponry. I mean, I don't know how you can afford to move Nils Höglander, for example, but that would be a desirable trade chip for a lot of teams. Your 2025 first, that would have a lot of buying power. For the right guy, would you consider moving a Tom Volander? I think you might have to, right? Like, I do. I think you might have to at least strongly consider it. And then the last part is, we've seen how effective this management group can be navigating trade talks in season. And I think there's a real opportunity there, right? Like, the supply-demand equation shifts where teams, you know, are hungry for players and have cap space in the offseason. And then during the season, they're desperate for cap space. And there's interesting buying opportunities that can open up because there's just fewer bidders once you get in season. If plan B never presents itself in a desirable way, I do think this team should at least consider trusting this core group to carry them, mm-hmm. right? Maybe you try and swing at some singles. Maybe you try and swing at like a Danton Heinen and a Michael Amadio.
Jason Zucker.
Yes, right. Some singles. Some you know, short-term, $2 million kind of range guys who give you enough depth to stay afloat and go into next season and sort of wait for the opportunities to present themselves, because between, you know, Marner expiring and Ehlers expiring and the rental market for next offseason and on, you know, those opportunities do seem to come around every single year. And we've seen that this organization's really good at being aggressive in keeping tabs on and ultimately landing the guys they most want. So, you know, that to me, that's like leverage of strength, right? Like what are this front office's strengths? Well, making trades in season is definitely top of the line, mm-hmm. top of the list. And number two would be placing sharp value bets on guys capable of contributing an awful lot more than you're paying them. To me, you know, plan B of wait and see. Usually I don't like passivity in management approaches in hockey, but I actually think there's a good argument for it given the specific skill sets of this management group, the specific areas that this management group reliably eats, in combination with what I see as this club's critical need to land not a top six forward, right? Not a good player,
mm-hmm.
a star level top of the lineup guy. and nothing else will do, in my personal opinion.
And I think the other key for me is just like philosophically, let's say you miss out on trying to pay Jake Guentzel $10 million. You're not replacing that by signing two $5 million wingers, right? Like that does not add up to, oh, hey, it's just the same as we got Guentzel. You're missing that extra boost at the top of your lineup, and you have to be really, really careful about trying to make it up in the aggregate by signing a couple of guys, again, making around $5 million per. Okay, one piece of interesting, not directly Canucks-related, but as you said, a lot of people texting in asking about John Marino here, and the reason for that is there's a report from, let me have it here, because it's not a traditional NHL insider, Dan Powers, who's part of the Empty Netters pod. This is where it started.
Sorry,
so,
what are we talking about?
John Marino.
Oh, man.
Like, I gotta set the whole thing up.
What are we talking about?
What do you mean? What are we talking
about?
Who
is this person?
I don't know.
Why are we citing someone I don't know?
Because people are talking about it.
Oh, man.
But just, this happened. No,
just
hold
call
on.
It. Just call it wild rumors on Twitter, then.
I know, but I gotta say who it originated from.
Why?
I don't know. Why not?
If it's not credible, just say rumors.
I don't know if it's credible.
A lot of people chatting about this.
No. Hold on. This happens every year, though, where random, non-traditional insiders run into a piece of news that ends up being right.
Yeah, remember the Semir Javer era of Canucks hockey news? Do you remember this?
Not really.
Really?
No.
You don't?
No.
Semir Javer was, I believe, and please, if you're listening, because he makes sick Canucks pump-up videos, he still occasionally surfaces from time to time. I'm pretty sure he was like a high school kid at St. George's, and he just like randomly broke like four massive Canucks trades.
Yeah, it happens.
It was the Hodgson deal and the David Booth deal. So it was like whatever that was, like 2012.
Yeah,
2013. Yeah, like late stage Mike Gillis era. Semir Javer was like the Canucks insider you had to follow.
So it happens, is all I'm saying. I have no idea if this one is going to prove true or not. But anyway,
old heads will remember this. It was a good time.
The report is that New Jersey.
Report. What are we doing?
What do you want me to say?
There's rumors out there. I don't know.
New Jersey are the favorites to sign Brett Pesce. I mean, this is despite the fact that unrestricted free agency has not officially opened. I have no idea how they'd be able to do this without tampering, which, of course, never happens in the NHL. But that's the rumor out there. That the New Jersey Devils favorites to sign Brett Pesce. And of course, the Devils already have Dougie Hamilton, big time contract that he has on the right side.
You're telling me the team in Newark is hot after a Pesce?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the fit is perfect. Are
they going to make him a made guy?
Probably. They're going to pay him a lot.
I don't know, man. I don't think you never want to be a Pesce going to the ceremony to make you a made guy.
All right, Simone Nemec on the right side, and of course John Marino on the right side. So you think if you're going to spend a whole bunch of money on a right shot, no, I get it. Don't worry. Don't worry. I get it. If you're going to spend all that money on a right shot defenseman, or not a true free agency, when you already have those options, presumably you're moving a player. The obvious target there, because he's not making $9 million like Dougie Hamilton is. He's not a super high pedigree young right shot defenseman like Simone Nemec is John Marino, right? 27-year-old right-hand defenseman, 3 years left at $4.4 million per. Coming off a down season, I think his on-ice save percentage was the lowest in the NHL among qualifying players last year. But this is a guy who was signed by Jim Rutherford coming out of college, right? He was drafted by Edmonton, but Jim Rutherford in Pittsburgh traded for his rights and signed him to his entry-level deal. And I think when he was eventually traded from Pittsburgh to New Jersey, that the Canucks under Jim Rutherford were interested in that player as well.
I can confirm that, although given the...
What he actually went for, that couldn't have been that interesting. Because it was like Ty Smith in a second.
Correct. Although, I mean, they had very little cap space, but, you know, you could have... I mean, it was one of the big mysteries of that summer is the team spent a lot of money on Mikheyev when they had such glaring needs on the back end. So I think that was part of it, too. But again, like, if you thought you had a shot at Marino and you're signing Mikheyev, I mean, I still think that speaks volumes about your actual priorities. Anyway, yes, they do like the player.
Yeah. So I think there's reason to be interested in that. And frankly,
he's an awesome buy low target.
27 years old, 3 years, $4.4 million. So based on some of the deals we're going to see right shot defensemen make this summer, that's not a particularly onerous contract. And again, as you said, coming off a down season, but a guy who has traditionally had really strong defensive results, I think that is very, very interesting from a Canucks perspective.
Well, also, good defensively, but has mobility and moves the puck pretty well. I mean, I think that would be the sort of guy that could get Hronek onto the second pair. right? Like, that could be the sort of guy. Like, yeah, you could play Susie Marino, and I actually, that sounds pretty interesting to me, especially in tough minutes. But I also think that would open up the flexibility to play Hronek, Susie, or with Hughes, Marino, so that you have like multiple guys that can maybe make more dynamic plays with the puck on different pairs as sort of part of the approach to leveling up your sort of depth offensive attack.
And I think ultimately, now that you've paid Filip Hronek like you have, you still need another top four quality defenseman, and probably the easiest way from a cap perspective to do that is finding a buy low target, right? Finding someone that you don't have to pay market price as a free agent, that you don't have to sign to a big extension, but who's on a reasonable number and has a chance of bouncing back and giving you that type of value. So if those wild Twitter rumors do prove correct and the Devils sign Brett Pesce on July 1st and John Marino, we're going through a bunch of steps here, but and John Marino hits the trade market, then I think it gets pretty interesting for the Canucks on that player. We'll take a final break here. Final segment coming up. We'll get back into the Game 7 look ahead. Take your texts as well here. Final segment coming up, Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Mike Halford
and Jason Brough.
Join us for Halford and Brough in the Morning weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. on Sportsnet 650.
Or on demand anytime through your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance, live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. It is Game 7 of the Stanley Cup. Final NHL game of the season. It all comes down to this. Panthers, Oilers, and that's really underselling it. We have talked at length about the drama, the theater, the stakes in this game tonight. And of course, it will be on Sportsnet 650 at 5 o'clock. So you'll be able to hear it all right here on the station. Now, this text came in just as we are in break there into the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line from Erica in Burnaby, who says, has watching McDavid in the finals gotten you guys excited to see him play for Team Canada in the 2026 Olympics? So she's skipping the Four Nations tournament next year. But anyways, in the 2026 Olympics, I think it will be a lot of fun to see him play with guys like Crosby, MacKinnon, Makar, Bedard, which I think is probably true, certainly for 2026.
Oh,
probably
yeah.
Maybe for the Four Nations, too. We'll see.
I mean, the fact is that kid's going to go absolutely nuke next year, and I think he'll be in the Four Nations, but he'll for sure be in 2026.
And then she says it'll be conflicting, though, to see them play against half of the Canucks roster on Team USA. But to answer your initial question, I mean, I'm a huge international hockey fan.
That is not how it works.
What?
The moment Canucks star American players put on Team USA gear,
it's not conflicting.
Yeah. And start I had clutching
zero.
And grabbing at Canadian players, Canucks fans will immediately turn on them. We saw this with Ryan Kessler.
Yeah. I had zero conflict. Zero conflict watching Ryan Kessler in the 2010 Olympics.
What do you mean?
Zero conflict.
Well, but people did.
Oh, I didn't.
I agree with you. I didn't either. I was defending him on the streets of Vancouver. But people hated him, man.
No. I mean, like, zero conflict in the sense that rooting. Like
With Kessler, though, it took on a dimension where people were like, trade him! He doesn't respect Canada!
But can you not see it with Miller, maybe?
Yeah, 100%.
Also, I'm telling you right now, like, other than Sasha Barkov, no one in this postseason, not Sam Bennett, not Wyatt Johnston, not anybody, has done a better job, not Kopitar, not Deneau, has done a better job head-to-head on Connor McDavid than JT Miller. And partly, it was because JT Miller nailed the commit 18 infractions every shift, they can't call them all, and you're always in McDavid's way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, JT Miller water skied on Connor McDavid every time through the neutral zone, and it worked, and it was awesome. I'm not saying this to criticize him. It was sick. Although I would say, I wonder if the Panthers are watching some of the tape and being like, hey, where's this whistle for us? Where's this whistle? Because that would certainly be helpful. Anyway, the moment JT Miller does that, recreates that with head-to-head against McDavid, but McDavid's in Canada colors, Canucks fans are going to be like, no! Stop it! Leave McDavid alone. It's going to be so weird.
Yep. But yes, to answer the texter's question, I was already hyped, but I'm even more hyped watching him have this type of run to get the chance to just be a pure Connor McDavid supporter for however long they're in the tournament there. And by the way, you know, I know people's mileage will vary on the Four Nations Cup that's coming up next February, but I believe June 28th, the day of the draft, they're announcing the first six players for all of the teams who will be named to that roster.
Quinn Hughes is going to be one.
Quinn Hughes will be one, I would think, yeah. The Canada ones are, I think there's four mortal locks. McDavid, McKinnon, Makar, Crosby. Those are your top four, 100%.
Brad Marchand?
He would be in the mix for one of the other two.
Yes, I think you're right about those four.
I think the next two are, because we don't have a goalie to name as a mortal lock.
Heck no.
Like the other countries do. I don't know, like Braden Point? Is he at that level?
Oof. No, I don't think so.
Stamkos is kind of the like veteran nod, but is he even going to be on the? Is he a lock to make the team?
I feel so sick that he's not because remember he got hurt right before Sochi,
yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's just like he's another one of those guys who's just we're never going. Well, it's already locked in. We're never
not
going to
prime.
See Stamkos in his prime represent Canada, and that sucks. Just like absolutely sucks.
Yeah, but
anyway, so
I'm curious to see who the other two for Canada are. Quinn Hughes will be on there, I think, for the Americans for sure.
Probably
Pettersson for Sweden.
Pettersson for Sweden.
Yeah.
Do you think JT Miller is a mortal lock
for the first six? No. Well, I'd have to go through
Matthews,
it, but like Matthews for sure.
Matthews, Eichel.
Eichel, Quinn Hughes.
Kachuk. Both Kachuk.
Charlie McAvoy. Oh, yeah. Matthew Kachuk for sure. Probably
Matthew Kachuk
Brady.
For sure. No, just Matthew.
Yeah, Matthew.
McAvoy makes sense.
Charlie McAvoy. So, and then probably one of the goalies, I would think.
Hellebuck.
Yeah. Hellebuck.
Hellebuck, yeah.
So he could, but he's going to be right on the bubble, I would think, for the first six. But anyways, I'm a huge international hockey sucker, so I'm excited for this.
Yeah. Reinhardt, Braden Point.
I think Marchand's a good shout. As
I
the
think
veteran
it's Marchand.
Who's represented the team, still playing at a high level, I think he's got a good chance to be part of it. I think Point is another one, too.
Man. Is Zach Hyman going to be there? I think Zach Hyman's going to be in the
Chris
Kunitz
role.
Team. Yeah. Right?
You Zach think he's going to be one of the first six, though?
No.
No.
But he's going to be
He's going to make the team.
Who's the line mates? It's McDavid, Hyman, and...
I mean, I want Barzal.
See, but then doesn't that, like... Aren't you getting away from the speed thing if you're putting... Like, to me, okay, you can go full speed...
No, Hyman keeps up.
...with McDavid, Barzal, McKinnon, which would be sick.
So,
or you can go, like, full chemistry and build it around the McDavid-Hyman connection.
The freakish... McDavid has actually reached a point in his hockey-playing career where even though he is the fastest human being on the planet on ice and also somehow seems to move faster somehow with the puck than without it and can execute elite skilled plays at a full speed that no one can match. As amazing as all of that is, and it's really amazing, and I don't want to diminish it. The most freakish thing about McDavid now at this stage of his career is when you see him play a full 2 minutes on the power play, and it's like 115 seconds into a shift, he's still beating a guy to a puck and like still able to create it full throttle. It's like, how? There is a whole league 700 pro hockey players who are world-class athletes, fitness nuts, don't eat gluten, barely drink, spend all summer training. How are you that much fitter than that group of people? It doesn't make sense. And one guy who can keep up with him is Zach Hyman. Zach Hyman's like the only mortal who seems to be able to keep up with him and Dreisaitl. And there's huge value there because you have that third body who can actually like last for those shift lengths with those guys. You don't have the quick change. You always have them outnumbered down low. Like it matters. I just think at the end of the day, that's such a special attribute and so irreplaceable that I think that locks Zach Hyman in on McDavid's wing. Yeah, and I don't even worry about the speed thing.
I have no problem. Well, no, it's not so much that I wouldn't play Hyman with McDavid. I have no problem with that. It's just that I'm not then necessarily looking for like the hyperspeed factor on the other wing.
No,
you know
I
what I mean? It opens up more possibilities on the left wing.
My dream of a nuke speed line with Barzal, MacKinnon, and McDavid still exists, but McKinnon's commentary recently that he wants to play with Crosby. So I feel like we're going to get like an all Nova Scotia line.
See, I would do McDavid. I guess you're going to play Crosby down the middle, but I would almost do like Crosby, McDavid, Hyman.
I think that would be fun.
In terms of like the down low work of Hyman and Crosby with McDavid, I think that would be awesome.
Okay, you've sold me. But
I think Crosby, McDavid, Bedard.
I think we're seeing.
Oh, I like that spicy.
I think we're going to see Marchand, Crosby, MacKinnon.
Ooh, somebody just texted in also Marchand, McDavid, Hyman. But I think Marchand and Crosby are pretty locked in.
I like mine. Let's do generations together.
That would be sick. If they were playing like exhibition games to warm up, they'd like do that for fun. You know what I mean?
Crosby, McDavid, Bedard. That would be sick.
Yeah. That would actually
be really cool. I'm here for it.
Let's hope Connor Bedard gets to that point, man.
It's also very coast to coast, which I like.
That's true.
You know, like there's like
East Coast, Central, West Coast.
It's like as far away while still being countrymen as you can be in the entire planet. It's awesome.
All right. So anyways, that was a long-winded way to answer. Yes, I am excited to watch Connor McDavid play internationally for Team Canada next year and the year after that in the Olympics.
But I'm not excited for people to be like, trade JT Miller.
No.
Because he's doing his job better than anyone else.
And I think people got over it with Kessler pretty quick.
Man, the Olympics.
But there was a moment.
There was a huge moment. That Olympics, things got dire in terms of Kessler's. Now, Kessler can't help himself and actually was like running his mouth about it. But like, you don't think JT's going to do that?
No, of course. He's going to be hyped. He's going to be totally locked in.
He's going to do that because he needs to if he's going to win and he's going to want to win. That's it.
You know what would be the toughest is if Nikita Zadorov re-signs with the Canucks and then he was on Team Russia. Playing against Team Canada, and it's like he knows one mode, and it's I'm going to troll the heck out of the team I'm facing right now. That would be the most difficult one for Canucks fans to stomach if it came to pass.
I don't know if he's going to be on Team Russia.
Yeah, that's fair, or the Canucks for that matter. But right. I'm just saying, if it went that way. All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. By the way, Alan Calgary says McDavid got me so broken after the season that I might cheer against Canada. I hate how good he is. Al, I get it. You're in an emotional moment, but you don't mean that. You're not going to cheer against Canada. Well, embrace the opportunity to cheer for him. Once he pulls on the maple leaf, you'll be on board.
So I've recently been watching like a lot of Tom Brady content. I listened to his appearance on Cowherd. I'm really excited for him to do media. I watched a bunch of clips from his Patriots Hall of Fame thing. I watched the Dynasty documentary on Apple. I watched the roast? Brady roast on Netflix. Loved that. And I've been watching it and thinking to myself, man, it sucks that I rooted against this guy my entire life. Like, I loved the Rams in high school, like grade eight. I like rooted hard against him his first Super Bowl. I hated the Patriots all through my life. Like for 20 years, at no point did I ever root, not one time, for Tom Brady. Like by 2019, the comeback against the Falcons was like a horror movie for me. I hated it. And now I'm consuming all this content and I'm like, it would have been fun to just enjoy this. I probably would have enjoyed this more than like hoping that Eli Manning might save me once a decade. You know, I regret it. I actually now regret,
but see, I think
loathing the Patriots.
I think you can do both. Like, I think you can, because I always rooted against Tom Brady as well.
Yeah, I rooted against Kobe.
The only time I thought it was, I didn't have a big problem with Brady winning was when he got the one with the Bucks, because I thought it was kind of funny for Bill Belichick. So I was kind of okay with that.
Rooted against him then too.
Like, I wasn't excited about it, but I was like, well, this is pretty funny.
Yeah, no, it was funny. I mean, it was cool. Like, that was one of the coolest athletic accomplishments of my lifetime, to be honest with you, because it was more than just winning as a quarterback. It was like winning as a CEO. He like brought winning to an organization. I just thought that was sick.
But I think you can intensely root against an athlete without like failing to acknowledge their greatness. You know what I mean? And I think in some ways, the fact that you and I and so many people like us spent 20 years, hardcore rooting against Tom Brady. Like, that's reflective of his greatness, ultimately.
Oh, for sure.
You know
sure.
what I mean?
It's not like I didn't appreciate it. You know, like, I enjoyed rooting against him, but still, like, I just wish I'd enjoyed it in a different way. Or, like, you know, anyway, I truly...
So does Connor McDavid fall under the category, Zach and I were just having this conversation, of Tom Brady, LeBron James, where you probably shouldn't bet against him for Game 7? Like, we learned so much that you shouldn't bet against Tom Brady.
He's not there yet.
Right.
Right? Like, if he wins, then it's a... Then...
I also occasionally did okay betting against Tom Brady. I didn't do it regularly, but I did okay.
If you picked your spots, you could do really well.
100%. So long as you didn't bet Rams minus 17 and a half, you were fine.
Whoops. But I think if he wins, and if the Oilers win tonight, he's going to take on that aura where it's like 100%. You go into the playoffs next year and it's like, how do you justify picking against them in a series?
Especially because their team's so flawed.
Yeah.
You know, like there's so much about this Oilers team that I desperately would want to bet against as an analyst or as a sports bettor. And yet, you know, I absolutely think there's a world where McDavid's just going to win tonight.
Well, and the Brady comparison is kind of instructive there because other than the, you know, 18-1 year where they ultimately lose to the Giants, there were a lot of years where it's like they were a really good team. Don't get me wrong. But it wasn't like they were a record-setting, historically dominant team. And it's like, oh, there's no way this team could lose, right? And then they'd be in these close games in the playoffs or down 28-3 against the Falcons. And then somehow Tom Brady would find a way to win, right? And that was always like, that was the most frustrating thing rooting against him. It would be, you know, 3rd and 5 and they need to get this to sustain the drive and go down and kick a field goal to tie the game. And it was like, there's 100% chance that he's getting it. There's 100% chance that he's picking it up. And he did it time after time. And I think it is, again, if the Oilers win tonight, it's going to start to feel like that with Connor McDavid, right? And you think about the moments of, you know, Stuart Skinner, big save on Carter Verhaeghe, I think it was in Game 3. And then that game gets out of hand, right? The goal getting overturned, correctly so, but Chris Knobloch making the challenge last game. It's just there's going to be this aura of inevitability about it.
I wish we'd talked about that more. The Paul Maurice commentary after the fact where he was like, I wouldn't have challenged that. It's like, really? You wouldn't have put the Oilers power play on the ice?
Yeah.
You wouldn't have risked
doing
that.
It. Yeah.
Against, you know, like, Knobloch's got such a massive special teams edge that I honestly think he should be challenging 50-50s. His logic should be completely different than anyone else's ever has been, because this is the most dominant special teams team we've ever seen. I'd challenge almost every goal if it was close. If I had an inch of cause tonight, I think Knobloch should challenge. Even if it's hopeful, I think he should be challenging.
Yep.
I'm serious.
Well, like, their PK has been such a weapon.
Such a weapon.
It's been outscored by one in the playoffs?
They've outscored. Or certainly they have in this series.
In this series, but in the whole playoffs, they've been outscored by one.
-1. Three goals, 4-1, 4 against.
Which is insane.
Insane. So,
why wouldn't you? It's like, we draw. We draw these minutes anyways. Who cares if we're shorthanded for 2 minutes? It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So I thought that discussion sort of missed the tactical nuance of, like, if you're Edmonton, why wouldn't you challenge everything? I don't.
Well, I also just think, like,
I would never accept a goal against if I was Edmonton.
What? Just challenge for something. Go through the tape, guys.
Honestly,
see what's there.
Also, like, there have been such long stretches of this series where Florida's like building momentum and it looks like a power play for Florida, and then they actually get a power play and Edmonton takes over the game. Like, every penalty interrupts Florida's momentum. Every single one.
Mm-hmm.
That's how big an edge the Oilers have. Like, I literally think Knobloch has an opportunity to get a penalty called, which doesn't always happen in Game 7. Like,
I was going to say, the whistle tonight's going to be fascinating.
So why wouldn't you like, you can just interrupt Florida's 5-on-5 edge as much as you can. I'm not kidding. Like, it's an opportunity for Knobloch. I think he should use it.
Yeah,
and I think they should change the rule, because it's insane that you're giving a coach this much power.
That's an interesting point, right? In a series where special teams has favored one team so much, it does really change how teams are looking at the challenge as a weapon.
Yeah,
right?
Especially if you buy that, even if it's a coach's challenge power play, if the fact that there's a Panthers power play increases your likelihood of getting your power play on the ice. Like, I'm serious. I think this is such an extreme edge for Edmonton that they should consider something that we may never see again. I would. I'd at least talk about it.
Quickly.
Have my nerds run the math.
We've talked a lot about kind of the stakes of this game tonight and all of that, which I think makes sense. But just from an on-ice perspective, what are you expecting to see from this one, and especially from Florida's side? Like, what do they need to do successfully more than anything else to win this Game 7 tonight?
I mostly think they just need Sergei Bobrovsky to be startable.
Fine.
Yeah, startable. Because I don't think he has been since Game 4.
Yeah.
Or, sorry, since Game 3.
Game 3. Yeah.
Like, I think he's been really bad. So I think they need Bobrovsky to just be fine. Like, they need him to not get outplayed by Stuart Skinner by a significant margin. And I think if that happens, they're going to have a shot here. I also do think they're going to need to avoid having Sam Bennett's line on the ice against McDavid at all costs. I think they're going to have to hard match Barkov extremely hard. And then I think they're going to need, you know, whether it's Tkachuk. Like, if Tkachuk reprises what he did in Game 5, I think it's going to be a long night for the Oilers. But I think they're going to need that sort of push from their second line. Or their third line, or that Lundell-Lustarainen crew that was wrecking the Oilers early in the series, like, needs to show up and start wrecking the Oilers again. To me, it's like middle six lines need to be way better, and they need Bobrovsky to just be fine. And I think they can win, and I think they will win. Like, I think they should be favored tonight. I think it's wild that this is a pick'em price. I'm not saying Florida's, like, for sure going to win. I'm just saying I think it's mispriced that they're not a heavy favorite, given how important home ice has been in shaping the flow of play in games throughout this series.
That does it for us. Game 7 tonight. You can hear it here on Sportsnet 650. And either way, we will be back tomorrow to wrap it all up and officially kick off the NHL's offseason. That's on Canucks Talk tomorrow here on Sportsnet 650.